What's up, boys and girls? In this episode, I am talking to Bridger Pennington with Investment Fund Secrets all about how to start a fund and how funds can supercharge your business. It's a great episode. You'll love it. Also, I am starting a new project called Exit Plan Secrets. So if you are serious about having an exit in your business in the next 12 to 24 months, hit me up on Instagram or LinkedIn and tell me sell, DM me sell, and I will get you the information if you want to get involved. Hope you enjoy the episode. Peace.
And we're live. All right, today I'm stoked. If you're on Facebook at all, you've probably seen this guy's ads. They've been blowing up ads more and more. We got Bridger Pennington on the podcast today. We're doing a little bit new format. I also have my partner in crime and one of my businesses, Ryan Means, that's going to add some knowledge as well. And so, Bridger, give everybody a little 2 or 3 minute background on you and what it is that you do.
Yeah. So, hey, thanks for having me on the show. It's going to be way fun. I'm excited to hop on with you guys. My name is Bridger Pennington. I run an investment fund called Blackbridge Holdings. We ran that for about 4 years. And a fund, we'll probably dive into all that, but we run a fund and we raise money from investors deployed, and we do a lot of debt financing. So a lot of loan lending out of our fund. Started multiple other businesses, but right now, recently we started another business online. You're mentioning seeing ads, and I'm sorry, you've seen so many of our, you probably got-
I think it's great. I've bought it. I've been a customer of it. I think I was like in your OG offering.
Really?
I'm in there, bro. I've given you, I've paid for two of those bricks.
Yeah, you probably paid for some of these bricks back here. Yeah, so we started an online course to help people launch a scale fund. So myself, I've run a fund for a couple of years. My dad, co-founder of a deca-billion-dollar real estate family of funds. They're just crazy what they've been able to do. They have 117 funds. I mean, they're huge. We can probably talk about them too. And then my brother is a securities attorney and chief compliance officer at an $800 million fund right now. So between the three of us, we've got a pretty good background of people that understand how funds work, how they function. My dad started those funds. My brother, you know, pretty early on in those funds. My fund, they just started from the ground up. And all of us did it without going to Harvard. We didn't work on Wall Street, the traditional Ivy League route. And we've had a lot of people reach out to us and ask us, how do you guys do this? Like, how did just, you guys are, and they're like, you guys are so regular, like just regular Joes. There's nothing, we're not that sophisticated of people, but yet we were able to raise millions, and my dad, in his case, billions of dollars to go and launch and scale their investment strategies and funds. And so we started an online podcast and then eventually a program to just help teach people and share the stuff that we've learned along the way and to help other people launch and scale funds. And it's been pretty fun.
What was the switch for you when you were running the fund and you decided, I also want to teach people how to do this? Cause that's, I mean, it's easy to be in business and kind of be behind the scenes. You don't have to put yourself out there, and it takes a different type of commitment to put yourself out there. And so what was the tweak of like, I also want to get in the education side of this business outside of just doing the business itself?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually started to have a couple of family and friends ask us, myself, my dad, and my brother, how do you guys do this? And one of the biggest sparks for me was that one of my best friends, actually growing up in high school and stuff, he went and met with my dad. And my dad, we sat in on the conference room. I'd already started my fund. My dad sat down and whiteboarded out how funds work, how the SEC works, how to raise, just all the stuff you would need to know about a fund for about 2.5-3 hours. And my buddy left and he came back through. He was just way intrigued just how this worked. Came back 3 weeks later, learned some more. And my dad thought, he's like, you know what? I'm gonna teach these young guys in their 20s. They maybe will start a fund in 20 years, right? My friend, and I'd already started my fund. My friend started his fund in the next 6 months. They raised $10 million in their first year for their fund. And at that moment, I was like, dang, like this is an amazing business vehicle model. And we kept getting, because he was telling his friends to come meet with us. We had more and more people asking us to learn how to do this. And so we were kind of pulled into it a little bit. And then secondly, this is more on a personal note, I have a lifelong dream of being a high school, like motivational speaker. You know those guys that go to high school, like I love those guys growing up. And so I'm like, my goal in life is to make a ton of moolah. And then when I'm 50, just go speak at high school. It's going to be the funnest thing in the world. And so I was like, hey, I got to start practicing though. I got to start a podcast and probably practice being on camera and being in front of people and that whole stuff. And so we started it, and we just got so much traction and so much, I guess, I don't know, people listening and watching that we decided to just do more and more. And I brought on partners and stuff. So I have an incredible partner named Mason. He's actually right across this wall right here. He runs like that whole show, because I still got to run my fund every day. Right. But it's been a great way to give back and serve, and it's been really fun. So I really enjoy doing that side of things too. It's been awesome.
Which one do you prefer out of running your fund or running the information business?
I know you guys probably know this. It's really whatever company's doing well at the time. Like some months in my fund, we have a bad month. I'm like, dang, like this fund sucks. Like I wish I was just doing the information product. And like the other, like it'll switch sometimes. We get like a couple of refunds or people that like don't like us for whatever reason. Right. People online that are, you know, commenting, you're such an idiot, you're a scam.
The keyboard like warriors.
You know, and you're like, man, I never want to do this again. I just wanted the fund. And so it bounces back and forth for me.
Yeah.
Both are super lucrative models though. The reason, I intentionally chose those two business vehicles. Before my first fund, I started six different businesses before starting my fund. And I had tried everything. I mean, I was just like the kid in college. Like, I'm just going to hustle. I did wholesaling. I did Forex trading. I speak Mandarin Chinese. I did Mandarin Chinese tutoring, like everything. Right. And I like at my Chinese tutoring business, we had 9 tutors. We were tutoring all these kids, and I was making like $5 a lesson, right? Every time one of my tutors taught somebody, I'd make $5. And I was like, okay, for me to be a millionaire, I got to have like 1,000 tutors, you know, like doing. And I was like, man, this isn't a lucrative model. And so I started to look at more business models. What type of models produce a lot of money with very few people, have high margins? And I looked, and funds were one of them. Funds, I mean, there's 5 guys on Wall Street that'll manage $17 billion, right? It's pretty good returns. And then information products, right? Really good margins on information products, where when someone buys my product, the fulfillment is just an email, right? Just send them an email. And they have everything. So I intentionally got into both those businesses because the margins are so fat that even if you kind of suck at it, or you're just average, you'll still make a lot more money than a restaurant owner, right? Because the margins are so thin.
Yeah. And I want you to give kind of the top to bottom breakdown on a fund and carried interest. And we'll get into that. But one question that I have before we do that is, as you run your fund, you know, because I've opened a lot of businesses to varying success, more failures than successes, but the successes hit big. So my hesitation has always been, it seems like the fund is, you're in two businesses at the same time, right? So if I, you know, I've been in the trampoline park business, right? If I were, you have to manage the fund and acquiring capital and the accounting of the fund and the compliance of the fund, in addition to the main business that you're in. So how has that worked with the fund that you have in credit? What additional operational burden has putting a fund on that done versus just being in the credit repair business, which is a business that Ryan has been in before? But
yeah, great. It's a good question. And it depends on the fund you're running. Some funds are going to be vastly different, like a hedge fund. I mean, that is the business, right?
Right.
It's trading and just trading high amounts of volume. But all a fund is, in the most basic sense, all it is is a catalyst to scale. So if you have, you flipped one house or 3 houses, you bolt on a fund and now you can flip 85 houses. We actually have a student that did that, raise, you know, $5-6 million. He's already in the middle of flipping 85 houses right now. Same with trampoline parks, right? You opened one successfully. Hey, let's now just scale this thing and do 100 of them, right? You bolt on a fund and now you have all the money and resources to do it. So the operation does go up because you're now running 100 parks, right? That's a lot more operational. However, you got all the money to play with, right? So you have the one with the gold rules, right? The golden rule. So you have all the gold, you can hire out managers and people and just bring on partners and scale that way. And no one does it alone. No one on a huge mass business scale does it alone, right? You see Elon Musk. Elon has no clue how to build a car, how to build a rocket, how to build anything. He just knows how to say, hey, this is where we're going. Can I find some team members? I got a huge stock IPO evaluation. Let's go hire some people and let's do this, right? That's the same thing with a fund. It's just a catalyst to scale and really get to the big leagues with what you're doing. So in most of our operations, most funds I work with, there's typically one person that's really good at flipping real estate, or one person that's really good at setting up trampoline parks. There's usually another person that's really good at operating a fund. I mean, I'm kind of that person, really good at SEC compliance, legal stuff, accounting, all that, you know, internal, whatever it is. And then usually have another person that's a money raiser, really well networked, can raise capital from individuals, all that kind of stuff. And you partner up, and that's, yeah, it's a great way to scale.
That's awesome, man. I wish I'd heard these things like 3 years ago, Rob. Well, could have helped us out with,
what do you with mean? How we scale. I don't understand what you're insinuating.
I think we had a lot of issues with scaling that these could have solved.
Yeah, capital. Well, especially in a brick and mortar business where you don't have franchising as your model, and the biggest constraint to scale is capital. And we always did equity financing on a per location business, on a per location deal. And it definitely created some issues.
Bridger, I have a quick question. It's kind of a step back a little bit, but I've listened to you for like 10 minutes now, and I can tell you're never going to go work for anybody else. You've got this air of you're going to do your own thing. Have you ever worked for somebody else where you haven't been your own boss?
Early on and in college, I did a bunch of great internships that I absolutely loved. I worked for a company. I did an internship there and I loved it. I stayed. I worked for them for a year and a half. And they were kind of an upstart. They had about 45 employees and they were growing quickly. It was a really fun company to be at. Learned a ton from their owners. And I though, while doing that, always had, and I grew up in a very entrepreneurial home. My dad, before starting his fund, he started his first fund when he was about 40 years old. Before that, he had started like 10, 13 different businesses. So we lived the entrepreneurial kid life. You know, it's like the feast and famine and, you know, kind of thing. And I never knew what my dad did. And so from that, I set a goal at a young age. Like everyone that I knew that had money ran their own businesses with their own, had figured something out. And my dad always would tell me there's easy ways to make money in this world. And there's hard ways to make money in this world. Figure out some easy ways, right? And so I always had my eyes open like crazy. And I'll probably talk about my dad a lot today, but I have an incredible father. When I was starting my first fund, I pitched him for money, right? Because he's got all this money apparently, and he runs this big fund. And we lived in a very average house. I didn't know he was rich growing up. He's one of those guys that has millions in the bank and drives a crappy old Ford, you know, Focus or whatever. Has always lived that his entire life, and pitched him for money. And to this date, my dad has never invested in any of my funds. Still, I always pitch him too. I pitch him like every month. Dude, we got this great idea. You want to come in? He's like, nah, like you got to go figure this out on your own. And that's taught me way more than money would ever teach, right? He teaches though how to, hey, this is how you go pitch an investor. This is how you go find somebody. This is how you go approach this group. But back to the original question of working for other people. I did that great internship. I loved it. I wanted to get into the fund space, and the traditional route is you do investment banking or consulting. And so I was at Brigham Young University, which is a decent school. It's an okay school. It's not an Ivy League school, right? But they can still land people on, you know, on Wall Street and stuff. And I got a 4.0. I was doing really well. I got the great internship. I went to a huge firm out in Silicon Valley and I worked there for, you know, the whole summer. I got the six-figure offer to come work after I graduated. I got, you know, the six-figure, the bonus, the stock options, the whole package, right?
Was this a firm where you would be managing a fund?
It was a finance role, at this firm. I won't say the firm cause you know, whatever, but, I would work, you know, and hopefully work my way up the totem pole and maybe start a fund one day. Right. But typically the bottom tier, you're not doing anything, right. You're an analyst just scraping dirt off the floor. And I remember looking at that offer and looking at the next 10 years of my life, right. Cause that's most, you know, it's 10 year path. 2 years investment banker, you work 100 hours a week, then you do your MBA, then you come back and you slowly work into the hedge fund, private equity space. Maybe after 10 years, you can start making decisions in the business. And I love the quote, people overestimate they can do in 1 year and underestimate they can do in a decade. And I took a bet on myself. I said, hey, in 10 years, I bet I can beat all, because I had a bunch of buddies doing that. I bet I'm going to beat my buddies that are all doing the investment banking consulting route. And I'm going to pin myself to that goal. I'm going to be making more money in 10 years than them. And I said no to the offer. I went and started. The fund was already running. Did that. We started an investment fund. Seeker started a few other businesses, and we're on the path. So that's kind of a little bit my journey. But I've learned a lot from work for other people. I actually think it's a great way to learn.
I went down that path a little bit, and I went to the biggest law firm in Manhattan and worked there for 3 months and saw partners doing cocaine and just crazy stuff. And so I lasted 9 months at a big law firm before I quit to start a carnival house, just to do anything that wasn't what I was doing. I think that there are two things that have kept me back from a fund. One would be taking money from somebody else, right? Taking money from somebody else. And of the times that I've had investors in parks and in other businesses, I feel like the entrepreneur in me is always kind of like ready to do the next thing. And I, you know, having the responsibility and to take somebody's money. And then as I started producing more content on LinkedIn and some other avenues, as I have investors in trampoline parks, I'm always like, crap, I hope that like, they're not like, they don't think that I'm not thinking of, that I'm not taking the millions of dollars that they've given me seriously. Have you run into that as you have other businesses, other interests, or even starting separate funds that are maybe in different spaces?
It's a great question. And I could probably talk for 30 minutes on this, but number one, when you take money from, and you know this, when you take money from investors, it's a serious business. Once you take somebody else's money, you got to be serious about what you're doing, and because you have a fiduciary responsibility to them. And now with my stuff and in relation to, because we do online marketing stuff as well, I haven't had a problem with investors. I'm sure they've seen our stuff online because they're getting good returns. I've given my investors great returns consistently for the past 4 years. I'm sure though, if I had a down, I started to lose them money, I'm sure they would be like, Bridger, what are you doing? You're doing all these online videos and stuff. So we've been good there, and everyone's happy until you start losing money, right?
Yeah.
Now the nice thing, and kind of switching topic a little bit, the nice thing about a fund, some people are like, man, I don't want to deal with an investor because they'll always be nagging me. They're going to be, always trying to, they're going to come look at the property, or they're going to always be whatever, right? Being really annoying. Inside of a fund, the beautiful thing is, you are the general partner and you have complete control over the project. You could have an investor. That's why I mentioned before, five guys on Wall Street can manage $1 billion, and their biggest investor with $100 million calls them up and says, hey, I think you should sell the property. I need to pull my money out for tax reasons or whatever, right? You say, hey, the property's not ready to sell yet. And sorry. No, we're keeping, this is the fund. We have deciding interest over the fund. You're a limited partner. And now they can pull their money out. Usually it's a big penalty, maybe a 20, 30% penalty if they pull their money out. But that's the beautiful thing about a fund, is you have, control over, versus sometimes, depending on your contract with a syndicate or a franchisee, whatever, sometimes they have more leverage over you versus a fund. That's why funds typically, most people end up inside of funds. But I hope that answers your question.
Because the difference is, like, how we've done trampoline parks is we're all common stock shareholders, and so usually we have the majority, but the difference between GP and LP is the GP usually has decision making, and even if all the LPs agree, you can't, the limited partners versus the general partner, the limited partners can't overtake the general partner in the way that common shareholders can overtake if you lose your majority in any way. I'm trying to remember what my question was. I lost my train of thought.
I'll add to that too, and that's, yeah, it's a great, funds are a fantastic structure for that reason. Now, and if you lose money, you're protected in a lot of ways. Now, you don't want to plan on losing money. You don't want to do any of that, right? But if you did or things go south, investors are signing on an LPA and PPM, the two main documents for a fund. they're risking everything. They can lose all of their money inside of a fund, and they understand that, right? And so it you know, and it is still a responsibility. It's a weight on your shoulders, you know, managing someone else's money. And I feel that all the time. But typically, and we can dive into this, and you know, how to raise money, when I will never pitch an investor anything unless I am 100% in on it. And I'm going to put even my own, a significant amount of my net worth into the deal as well. I'm going to have skin in the game. I'm going to be all in with them. Hey, but I just, you know, I've only got so much capital on my end. I need a couple, you know, a couple more million from you or whatever it is to really make this thing scale. And typically I'm so confident on it that all that weight kind of sheds off because I'm so confident in it. And the other thing too, and the SEC has some good laws about this, about who you can take money from, whether it's accredited investors, qualified clients, or even qualified purchasers, which have a $5 million net worth. It helps a little bit knowing that these people can lose money, right? They're going to be just fine. If you take money from non-accredited, like your neighbor that has $5,000, you know, I took money from a non-accredited investor one time. It was $5,000. It was literally $5,000. I took it from him because he wanted to invest. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll let you. He's one of my buddies. He calls me like 3 days later. Like, dude, how's the $5,000 doing? I'm like, dude, it's been 3 days. Like, it's good. Like, it's fine. You're good. He calls me the following Tuesday. Like, hey, like the $5,000, I might need to pull it out. And I was like, dude, you're out. Like, you're done. And I'm like, take your money back. You can even take interest for a couple of days, whatever. Just, I'm done. Like, I'm not dealing with you. And I only take money right now from qualified clients. So they have to have a $2.1 million net worth to be in my fund. And for other SEC reasons, I do that as well. So I can charge different fees to them. But I do that because if I lose one of, you know, some of their money, and these guys that I'm taking money, it's going to hurt. They're going to hate me. It's going to hurt my reputation, but they're going to still sleep at night. They can still feed their families. It's going to be okay. And so that helps me a lot on that end of things.
One question that I have is usually you're raising money, even if it's a debt fund, you're taking basically equity in the deal. And how does it work? If I have $1 million fund, how do I go about taking bank debt, putting leverage on top of the funds that I have within my fund? How does that usually work in practicality?
Yeah, it depends on the type of fund you're running. So it'll vary between hedge funds or private equity or venture capital fund, but all those funds, they run, you guys know this, but they all run on the same structure.
Yeah.
It's the exact same format. And a lot of people don't know that. They think they're totally different. These are all the same things. They're just investing in the different assets. And so how to apply leverage, it's going to be a little bit different for each one, but most of those things they're investing in, real estate's a great example. It'd just be like a mortgage, right? So your entity is the fund. You're going to go buy maybe you've got $1 million and you want to leverage, you know, 50% leverage. So you're going to put $1 million down there. The bank's going to finance another $1 million, right? So you can buy a $2 million property. That's how it works. A hedge fund will use a prime broker typically, and they can leverage up their trades if they want to.
Yeah.
A private equity will do a leverage buyout. So they'll say, hey, we're buying $100 million company. We'll put in 40 million equity. And then the bank will say, great, we'll finance it. And typically with a fund, you can get a lot better rates because you're a big player. You're a big fish. And so interest rates are going to be way lower than a retail trader or a one-off person. So that's, you can apply leverage to, you know, pretty much any asset class. Debt is, for mine, is the only one that's a little bit hard. So debt, because some banks, they don't like the fact that they're giving me a loan so I can give someone else a loan, right? So I run a debt fund. That's the one that's a little bit hard to get leverage on. Most of our loans are not leveraged at all. The only leverage we've slowly been able to negotiate with banks is just give them us a line of credit. So they'll give us lines of credit that we can draw down.
It's just a revolver.
Just as a revolver, yeah. But typically, we don't lever up a ton on our deals. We're charging enough interest and points and whatever, and we're turning our loans fast enough that we don't need to, and we actually can't right now. Most of them want some kind of asset that's tangible that they can take if the deal goes bad.
And so on your fund, what does it look like from how many employees do you have that are doing the actual business of originating loans and deploying the debt versus managing the fund side? Is it just your accountant does both, you know, your CFO, whatever, is doing both, or you have your fund guys and then the business?
Yeah, great question. And every fund will vary drastically. My dad's real estate fund, they have 4,000 employees and they manage about $20 billion. There's other funds that manage $20 billion and have 50 employees, right? So it varies drastically by the assets you're in. My fund specifically, I do a lot of the capital raising, the fund management. I have a great manager named Ryan. He helps originate, and him and a team of people, we've shifted that team a lot. So it'll vary from 2 people to 5 people. Not a ton though. We don't need a ton. Right. People. They're looking at loans or grabbing them, looking through a lot of them, and they just qualify them and we send wires.
What type of loan are these? Consumer loans or?
Consumer and business. We'll do, we do a lot of different, sometimes hard money loans on properties. Sure. We'll estate. Do, credit card financing loans, sometimes debt consolidation loans. We do a mix of stuff. We'll do, yeah, anything that'll make us money essentially in our scope and realm. And then on the actual fund management piece, I help there. We have a, you know, accountant, auditor, a few other people that we hire out third party to just come and help us do all that kind of stuff. So it's actually a relatively small team. Most funds are actually pretty small, which makes it really nice. You don't have to have a ton of people, huge payroll. You can have pretty tight knit teams.
Yeah, that's and this people. It takes running a business like Ryan and I have run, where we have 150 employees. You have to go through that process once, because entrepreneurs are always like, and brag. Like if I've been on Clubhouse for the past little bit, and everyone brags about how big of a team they have. And I like when I'm looking for businesses to buy, I want to see people that are making a lot of money with like 2 part-time employees. It's like, oh, this is actually a legit business. Not like, oh, I'm a CEO of 200 employees. That's just a massive headache. But
it gets a lot. And you guys know that you guys have a lot of employees. I've kept my stuff pretty small, and I've tried to at least, but you got to grow. So Clubhouse is interesting too. I've wasted so much time on Clubhouse.
Oh no.
I also learned a lot of good stuff. It's interesting.
Yeah. It's like a coach's, candy store. You have all these gurus and coaches, but there's been a ton of good stuff. I want to hear about the failures that you had before starting the fund and why you think those things failed. And you don't have to go through it. You can give me the highlight, the 2 or 3. I think that's the lessons that I will always keep are from the businesses that I've started. You know, like you can have success 10,000 ways, and there's a bunch of luck and catching the right wave and doing all that. But the failures are always super interesting, and they're lessons that you never forget.
A bunch come to mind. I'll pop through a few of them. So I mentioned before my fund, that was kind of my first successful business that took off. I had 6 like true business attempts, not like business ideas or like, oh, it'd be cool. Like these were up and running businesses with bank accounts and, you know, running, right? One of them that really shifted my mind was I want to do an information product. So I decided on information product. I'm like, that's awesome, right? I want to do that. And I'd partnered with 2 guys that had both done a lot of real estate. And you're going to launch a real estate course. And these guys were seriously experts. They had flipped 300 houses combined. They were going to teach people how to flip houses in like a full out course. The course actually taught me how to go and flip a house. So I was like the newbie, and then they would teach me, and that's kind of, and I was the marketing guy behind it. So I was running the ads and all that kind of stuff. We spent about 8 months filming. We had a professional film team come in. They filmed everything. It was awesome. It actually looked incredible. We put this whole course, 12 hours of content together. And then we went and tried to sell. And I was the marketing guy, and we went and we did webinars, and we were doing all the marketing ads and everything. And we spent like 10 grand and we made back like 10 grand. Right, we broke even, which for information products, you should be making a lot of money on a $1,000 course. And we kept running, we're trying and trying, and we just kept hitting wall after wall, and ads are really expensive. And I finally was like, dang, why didn't we why didn't we actually go out and validate this market? Which is, you read that in every business book. I had read it before, but I just didn't put it into practice. I was like, we did the market surveys, right? We did that kind of testing where you go and ask campaign, and we had, you know, some people opt in. We're like, yeah, this is going to be sweet. But when it came down to people buying our offer, people were hesitant to pull out their credit cards for whatever reason, right? And so A few things I learned from that was, number one, and this is how we launch every business now, we always sell first. I always, even with funds, that's how I teach people how to launch funds. I say, before you hire a lawyer or do anything, go and pitch investors. Go do, get soft commitments from investors. Before you spend a dollar on a lawyer, go get your pitch deck together, get your deal, and go pitch money. We're doing this. I'm launching a third fund right now. Spent zero on lawyers. We've raised about $15 million in soft commitments, right? So who knows what that actually means. But what it does, though, is it goes, okay, people like this idea. They're willing to put money in. Now let's go spend the money and do all the work, right? It's actually the same way we launched Investment Fund Secrets. We ran ads. So this is a wild way to launch business, but we thought, let's do this. So we gave ourselves, and I had a great professor in college. He'd started all these businesses. He told us this rule that changed my life. And he said, for any business you start, give yourself a timeline and a budget. And he said, for 99% of the businesses that you guys want to do in this room, 3 weeks and $500, and you're going to figure out if this business is a good idea or not. And so we said, okay, we'll put them up in the challenge. We took 3 weeks and $500 into ad spend. We made 16 ads. We made a landing page, and that was it, and a checkout page. And we spent $500, and you might've been one of these OG buyers, but we sent all these ads, you know, and it said, oh, you know, the program's locked out, but hey, we've got this product for $47. It's called a mini vault. And you want in. The whole goal was just to liquidate our ads, just to pay for our ads.
Yeah.
In the first weekend, we turned that $500 into $1,800.
Awesome.
And we were like, whoa.
I bought the mini vault. I think I did a $47 mini vault. So
did you? Oh, that was probably you. So there you go. So there was no product built, and we were just emailing people like, hey, it's not ready yet. If you want, and we just said, hey, if you want a refund, you can have a refund. We were just trying to test stuff out, but it'll be ready in like a couple of days if you want to just wait. And most people waited. And so I went to my brother-in-law is a pretty famous YouTuber, and he's got an awesome studio. So I went to his house and we filmed for 3 days straight, edited, and we made this course of like 15 videos, and we gave to people. And we were like, wow, that actually, and we started, and we, what it allowed us to do was test. And now we had a group of people. We built an audience over about 3 months. We sold that mini vault course, and we had a whole locked content section for our mastermind that we sell. And, people were begging us to get in the locked section. And we're like, oh, you know, it's not open yet. It wasn't built. Like, we had nothing, right?
Yeah.
And we'd ask them, how much would you spend on it? What do you want to see in there? And that was our practice. And then we launched that mastermind just to our list, and we did a webinar, and we did $147,000 over a weekend on that launch. And it was all profit. And we were
Was the price point? What was the price point that you
had? Two grand.
Which is that still the same price point?
I think so. Yeah. We still sell for $2,000. So, and we've just added now we had built about 70 videos. We had all these mentors come on. Now it's about doubled. That's about a year ago. We've doubled our content and stuff on there. But that's how we launched that business. And that I learned that entire lesson was learned from that first business that we failed on starting slow. And I think money loves speed. And I've been in too many business conversations where, you know, I don't know if you guys do this, but you hop on a Zoom call like this, and everyone talks about, yeah, let's start a business and this is going to be great. And okay, you do this and I'll do this. And then you come back next week and no one's done anything, right? And it takes one person in that group just saying, we're doing this. I don't care. You guys can come if you want, but I'm going. And money loves speed. And so any business we ever started is we launch it fast. We try to taste blood as quickly as possible, taste money. Because when you taste money, everybody works harder.
Yeah.
And so I learned all those lessons from that one business in particular. It was a big failure. I spent a year of my life working on. I was like, never again. I'm not doing this ever again. And it changed my perspective on how to launch businesses. And almost every business we've launched since then has done well over six figures into the seven figure range. It's been awesome.
And has that been mostly fund based businesses and plus information products? The subsequent businesses that you've launched, have you been staying in those two spaces?
Yeah, primarily. Yeah, we've been staying in those spaces. I've had other, as you always get like shiny object syndrome, you know.
Yeah.
I decided like, hey, I'm going to focus on this for the next, you know, 18 months, and so I've helped a few other people launch their businesses, but I'm like, hey, I'm not going to put an, you know, investment stake in there. But we focus mainly on just funds and information products. It's kind of our two verticals for now, at least. Maybe 18 months later, we'll do something else. But
Yeah, I found for me at least, what I'm trying to do now to avoid my shiny object syndrome is like, will I commit to this for 3 years before I even get going on it? Because otherwise I can't. I'm like 2 weeks into something and then I bail. And I think it's also tasting blood and creating a sale. That's such a key insight and driving energy and momentum to the business. Cause before that, sell first and then build second has, that's huge. If only yeah, there that, were a way that to do was that.
Huge for me. The fail fast, fail cheap mentality is kind of what we live for. And it's funny when you get it, like you mentioned the first sale, and you guys have probably done this in your businesses, but everyone wakes up the next day like, crap, now we got to fulfill. Now we got to build something. We got to do something better. And everybody starts working all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And the day before, everyone was sleeping in or no one knew your partners were doing anything. And so I've made that a point. We have to, and it makes you commit. It makes you go in and do stuff and work hard. So
I think it'd be, so what do you talk about in your mastermind and some of your courses in terms of like, I think it'd be interesting to hear, I guess, how validated the idea is in a pitch deck as you go to an investor, right? So it's not just, I would assume, and I've pitched enough investors. I think it was really easy to sell investors on our concept because we had been in the business for a long time, right? And so the business had been validated in a big way, in a way that I think it'd be super helpful to hear how you sell before validating in a fun sense of if I think it's prime to go out and start buying RV parks and how validated and tested and do you need to be before you can really go out and be in front of investors in that way? Because I know in the startup world it's like if you're always launching too late. You always are on the product too much, just like you were working on this real estate thing too much. Mm-hmm. I don't use that same principle when I go to investors because of the fiduciary side of like being in the money, but I think it'd be super interesting to hear how tested out the core thesis of the fund needs to be to have a successful fundraise.
Great. Yeah, seriously, a fantastic question. There's a bunch of angles I could go. We teach people what we call the fund launch formula, and it answers that question directly about how to validate. Number one, the first step we tell everybody is find an incredible deal or thesis. And there's four simple, it's four steps, and we kind of try to make it simple, but it's really complex, to get into it. But yeah. We talk about the step one is find an incredible deal. And I won't go too long, but we can dive into it about how that looks and works. My dad, though, their first successful raise, they raised $100 million and they would go pitch investors. They found a great property in Miami, right? And they would say, hey, this property is incredible. We're gonna go flip this huge multifamily property. We're gonna buy it for $45 million, whatever. And they brought on other partners. So number one is bring on other people with track record. If you don't have the track record, bring on other people that have it. So partnering with guys like you that have already done the trampoline parks or partnering somebody else that's already done it is huge, and it gives you tons of validity for your deal. Number two, I love to pitch the deal. It's way harder to pitch a theory.
The concept,
We theorize we're gonna go find commercial real estate in the next 18 months. It's like, no, we found one right here. We got to close in 30 days. Wait, and hey, you've done real estate before. Put on your real estate hat. Come look at it. Call in your friend and poke holes in our deal. But this is a amazing bulletproof deal. When you do that, and either yourself build a track record through now, you can partner with somebody, take their track record. If you want to build a track record yourself, we talk to people through doing syndications.
Yep.
There are a lot of great ways to, if you want to be the expert investor, the one that's trading cryptocurrency, just start trading your own money, right? Trading your own money, start a small portfolio, and you can do, there's a bunch of stuff we teach. Incubator hedge funds is a great one. To start an incubator hedge fund, you can raise, maybe $8,000-$10,000 in there, 20 grand. Start trading that, get bigger. You can actually go as big as you want in there. They're really cheap to set up. Use the same thing with real estate. Start flipping small houses. If you want to build it, do that for a while. And then once you feel like you've proven the model out, then and only then, you know, go and do a big fund. But people do, you know, all ways, shapes, and forms. And I think the fastest way is partnering with somebody who already has the track record. If you want to do the fund, and that's what our third fund right now, I'm partnered with a guy, a really smart guy, very well networked. I call them broke geniuses. And they're not broke, they're making a couple hundred grand a year, they're doing okay, but they have no clue how to scale a business. They have no clue how to raise money, how to sell investors. All they know how to do is trade commodities every morning, right, for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And you go, hey, you keep trading, just let me partner with you, I will do the scale part. Do you think you could trade, you know, 10 million or 100 million if I gave it to you? And if they say yes, and they feel confident about it, and you run the models and everything, then great, let's go out and do it. I think that's a much quicker way to get that validity and track record. But you start where you're at and use the skills you have and grow from there.
Yeah.
Does that kind of make sense?
No, yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And what, how do you structure that on the fund side? If I have a crypto genius and I'm going to be, I assume you're taking the fundraiser role, right? So how does that work from how do you usually split up the fund between, I guess it's usually a fundraiser, the actual operating genius, and then probably some compliance.
Yeah. People. Yeah. I have three buckets. Yeah. We're just, you said, so money raiser person, fund administrator, kind of a fund admin, fund almost operations person, and then an expert investor, a person that's really good at the expertise of the fund. So I kind of put three different buckets there, and eventually you'll be a sliver of one of those buckets, you know, as you grow. And you can do two of the three, you can do one of the three, all three. You know, I did all three buckets when I started my first fund.
Yeah.
Typically, I mean, equity, it's so hard to say, right, of who you're bringing on.
Right.
You know, if you're bringing on the best trader to ever live, you know, Warren Buffett's brainchild, you know, whatever, whoever it is, right? Like, yeah, let's give them
some equity. Zero. Yeah. Let's give him 99%.
Yeah. Typically I see those buckets in just thirds, right?
Right.
Third most expert investor, third to like to the, you know, the legal compliance, admin, accounting, and that third to the money raiser. But it depends if you bring on, you know, the Rothschilds, you know, and right, you're going to give them more equity, right? So it's just like any other business, how you negotiate those terms. But I see them, you know, thirds is kind of, I think, a good way to start. And then you can slowly kind of tweak from there.
And what do you do? So talk a little bit about, the economics of the fund and the split and carried interest and just high level.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So how do fund managers get paid, right? It's a great question. How does it all work? Most people know the model like 2 and 20 fund. Most people have heard that. And what that means is 2% management fee, 20% carried interest. And I'll walk you through kind of what all that means. But most funds are a little more complex than that. You know, that's kind of that's the high level, but when you get down to the nitty gritty, it's a little more complex. So I'll give you an example, hopefully with my hands, people listening, I'll try to walk
you. You're a hand talker, that's good.
It's usually easier with a whiteboard. Like an example, let's say we have a fund and we're targeting a 22% return. Let's say we got it this year, right? How would everything split up? Most funds will do the first little bit of the fund is called a pref, or preferential rate of return. So in my fund, I do an 8% pref, meaning the first 8% of all returns go to my investor. So if this year we got a 9%, right, the first 8% would still go to my investor. The ninth in my fund, the ninth and 10th percentile are called the catch-up. So the ninth and 10th percentile come to me, Bridger, as the fund manager, okay? So that's, and these are performance-based fees, right? If I perform, I get paid, right? So my incentives are aligned with my investors. Above 10%, we split 80-20. So from 10, and in my fund, it actually goes 10 to 20, but above 10%, we split 80-20, 80% to the investor, 20% to the fund manager. So for example, if we got a 16% return this year, the first 8% would go to the investor, next 2% would come to me as the fund manager, and then from 10 to 16, we would split 80-20. So 80% to the investor, 20% to me. Now, in my fund, if I get over a 20% IRR, we then split 50-50. So I'm incentivized to get higher returns. If I get over 20% returns, then I get into the bonus round essentially as a fund manager. That is all called carried interest, usually in performance-based fees. Now you might be like sitting there like, well, Bridger, I'm not in the, like that total, if you total that together, it's like 4.4%, right? Your fund does 22, but you only take home like 4%. But inside of a fund, you're not taking home 4.4% on your own money. You're taking home 4.4% on the entire fund. So if you have a $100 million fund, you just took home $4.4 million that year. If you have a $1 billion fund, you're taking home $44 million, right? If you're Ray Dalio and you manage $400 billion, like 4% sounds pretty good, right? And so that's why fund managers make so much money. Now, the other thing that's amazing about funds is the IRS a while back wanted to incentivize fund managers to set up funds. And so they gave a huge tax benefit for fund managers. Most fund managers, that carried interest is like your main income. That's where you're making most of your money. That is taxed at capital gains rates. And Trump just tweaked it. So it's going to be, it's a little bit above capital gains. It's now to 25%. But still, that's why Trump and Mitt Romney and stuff, they don't want to share their tax returns because those guys run funds and they pay very little in taxes, especially real estate funds where you can depreciate, right? They pay super little in taxes. And fund managers, traditionally, they make a ton of money and pay very little in taxes, which is awesome. And the IRS does it because they want to incentivize funds. Funds grab money from international investors. They bring it to the United States. They invest in it. They stimulate economies, hopefully, unless they're like a private equity firm that tears apart businesses or whatever. But that's typically what you're seeing. Now, I'm sure people are wondering, what about management fees, right? So back to the 2 and 20. So we talked about the 20% carry, and you can tweak that. You can do 70-30 or 50-50 or whatever. A lot of funds will charge a management fee up front. So and a lot of times it's 2%. So that's 2% taken off the top, just of AUM, and that pays for expenses or salaries, whatever. My dad taught me something really interesting for my fund. He said, Bridger, if you don't charge a management fee, okay, if you don't do a management fee, all you have is a pref and a carry. You only make money on performance fees. You don't have to have a license. Mm. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, if you want to charge two fees, you need to have a Series 65 or a Series 7 depending on your state. But if you only charge performance fees, you're not advising the fund. You're just a general partner making performance fees, and you take money from, and there's certain qualifications and stuff. You don't have a license. And so I don't hold any licenses. I do not have a 65, a 7, or any 63. I have nothing right now. I've run a fund for 4 years and launching another fund. And so if you set it up, and there's a lot of things like that where you can get around a lot of regulation and stuff like that if you just know what you're doing. That's what we help teach people how to do inside of there. But does that kind of make sense, though?
I hope anyone who's listening understands the importance of that last piece of waiving that 2% deal and avoiding the qualifications that you need. That's a huge.
It's huge, and it depends on your state too, right? Every state's gonna have a little bit
blue sky,
check
whatever.
Your state or whatever. But typically, that's what we see across the United States. Now, that's the only way you can make money is on performance. If you make money, you know, you have a property management company that manages, you make money there, that won't count. The only way you make money is off performance of the fund. It's a nice little loophole in the SEC tax code that you can do that, or the licensing code, which is pretty fun.
I think, and I don't know, Means, if you have any questions, but I think as we kind of come up on time, I think it'd be super interesting to hear about what you think are, ideas that you've seen people within the mastermind that are executing that you think are good. The core, I mean, obviously fund will supercharge anything, right? But the core ideas that you're seeing right now, or that you're executing right now, that you think like, I think there's a green field opportunity there people should pay more attention to.
It's been actually really fun to have our group, and we have almost, 900 members in there, and to see all the different funds they're doing is wild. So I'll give you a few examples just to get your mind spinning a little bit about what funds are out there, and they're very successful funds. We have two guys in our group. They partner up actually in our group. They buy Amazon businesses with their fund. They'll go pitch a 23-year-old and buy it for 50 grand, right? They scale, they put together 10 or 15 of these Amazon businesses into one roof, takes down their cost, they can get better financing, all they work better with Amazon, whatever it is. They can hold more inventory. They scale, and they're good at scaling Amazon businesses. They scale all those up to netting or profiting $2 to $5 million a year. And they do one of two things. Number one is they just pay off their, or they sell the Amazon businesses and they pay off everyone a big dividend. Or number two is they actually, in their papers, they can just pay off their investors. So they give their investor, you know, their 16% return and plus their principal, they pay them out. And now their investor is out of the fund. And they now have a business that nets $3 to $5 million a year with nobody else. They aren't paying. It's just a cash flow business. It's awesome, right? And they're like, hey, let's do, and they, so they've already done one group. They're doing another group right now, and they're going and buying businesses. Another guy, friend of mine, he goes and buys up funeral homes. So he goes around, he buys up 9 to 10 mom and pop funeral homes, and he found he can sell them for double on the public, he says the public markets, but to bigger, you know, firms or whatever.
Right.
So he'll, every year, he does it like once a year, he'll buy up $9 million worth of funeral homes, and he sells them for $18 million. And he nets $9 million. He's got to pay an investor, investors, and he takes home about $1.5-2 million a year. That's it. That's all he does, right? It's wild. Like, that's it. That's all you do for your work.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. You can set a fund. Other people in our funds have almond farm funds. So guys in our group that are they're buying scripts off of Hollywood writers for like 20 grand of script, selling it to HBO, to Netflix, to Amazon Prime for 100, 200 grand a script if they feel like they're good enough. So we've seen all sorts of stuff. But back to your original question of where's a, you know, a blue ocean opportunity or a green pasture, right? The world is changing a ton right now. We've seen, and you guys know this, so I won't hash out what's been going on, but one thing that's been very interesting to me is, and my dad and myself, my brother, we talk about this at dinner, like every Sunday when we get together, we'd always talk about negative interest rates. I read a report in 2017, or maybe late 2017, early 2018, there was $13 trillion, trillion with a tree, trillion with a tree, trillion dollars trading at zero or negative interest rates in Europe, right? It's wild. Now, and then fast forward a year later, beginning of 2019, the Fed announces that they are going to raise interest rates 3 times in 2019. This is before coronavirus, okay? This is what they were planning to do. We're going to raise interest rates slowly. And they announced these are the smartest people in the world, the Fed, the most powerful, and they're a private organization, the Fed, right? It's a private company. It's not a government organization. It's a private company, the Fed, ran by the 12 largest bank owners in the world, right? With the Jeremy Powell appointed from President Trump, right? This is them. Less than 90 days later, they go, whoops, we made a mistake. We're actually going to lower interest rates 3 times in 2019, right? They lower interest rates. And then I check on negative interest rates. They're up to $19 trillion trading in Europe at negative zero or negative interest rates. 2020 hits, and they've put interest rates almost to zero, right? And monetary policy has been all over the place this year. But I bring that up because that tells you something that's going on in the world. Right, that tells you on a macro level what is happening on the planet. We have a family friend lives in Denmark. What does negative interest rates mean, right? What does that even mean? We have a family friend in Denmark. He has a mortgage on his house. It's an adjustable rate mortgage with no floor. The rates went negative a couple years ago. His mortgage company pays him $23 a month, something like that, to have a mortgage. That's what negative interest rates means. Right? Like, it is a guaranteed loss. When you invest into a negative interest rate bond, you're guaranteeing a loss. My dad is a good friend. He runs a big, big mutual kind of pension plan fund out of Europe. And every Friday, theoretically, a big, you know, everyone's paycheck, there's a portion that goes to their big pension plan. He gets a big pile of money on his desk every Friday, right? And his charter is to buy bonds, government-backed securities. And so the rates went negative last year. And he's like, well, I'm not going to buy them. right? Like, I'm not buying a negative bond. Like, why would I do that? So he just sits and the money just keeps piling up. He's sitting in cash and cash and more and more. Finally, the government comes to him and says, if you don't deploy this capital, we're going to remove your charter. You're going to be kicked down. He goes, well, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to buy negative bond? Like, this is a guy. And he goes, you have to buy or you're going to be removed. So he goes, okay. So he said, I started to buy negative interest rate bonds, which tells you that theoretically what that means is holding a bond that guarantees a loss is safer than holding cash, right? That's what that means in theory. It's almost like you're sitting on a beach covered in sand, right? A big beach. And Ryan comes up to me and says, hey, Bridger, can you hold my cup of sand for me? And I go, sure. Well, it's going to cost you a few pennies, but yeah, I'll hold your sand for you for an hour before you get back. That's how worthless our money has become. And now we're, you know, we can go into the doomsday talk of the dollar's going to be worthless, all that stuff. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think the U.S. has printed a lot of money. 21% of all dollars have been printed in 2020. It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
They keep telling us inflation is 2%. That's a total lie, right? And it's been a lie for 10 years, right? Or 20 years, whatever. The price of your steak has not gone up 2%. It's gone up, you know, a ton, right? And they keep manipulating that price. And there's two schools of thought on that anyways. I won't dive into that unless you guys want to. But it's very interesting what's going on in the world. And, you know, so you have alternative, you have, you know, Bitcoin, you have other value, gold or silver, other stores of value. That are interesting, right? That are something to look at. I think it's something to be aware of about the value of assets, right? We've seen this huge run in the stock market. Companies aren't making more money, right? No one's making more revenue. There is so much money out there. So a few things to take away, and we can dive into more of this.
I think it's interesting to, so, you know, we have to enter into an inflationary state at some point. What do you think are some opportunities that will be second order effects, assuming that we enter into, you know, inflation, right? Because that's basically what the idea is, that there's too much money out there for us to not have inflation to, that we'll have to eat away at the deficit, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, and this is the, you know, you read it, you look at an economic model and it should be here, right? And it's way below. And the economic model that should happen when you print that many dollars isn't happening, right? But things that typically happen with inflation, equities usually respond the first. So, you know, just your typical stocks that are, you know, tech stocks, that's too the first response. Then you get down to commodities and typically real estate follows that after for inflationary assets. That's typically in the past that's happened, but I'm not giving financial advice here or anything, right? But the kind of the interesting takeaways though from what is happening in the world, right? Number one, there's lots of money. So stop telling yourself there's not enough money to raise. There's no money out there. There is plenty. There's too much money, right? There's too much money out there. So then secondly, if you can find yield in whatever you're doing, and especially a fund, right? If you can find yield in whatever's going on, money will find you, right? If people are buying $18 trillion at a loss, they can put $20 million into your idea, right? And so that's the second takeaway I tell people a lot is, if that's going on, you can definitely raise money for a fund. But we see, you know, I personally though, the Fed is different. The Fed is the most powerful organization on the planet. They are gonna do something and they'll change the rules. They'll figure it out. That's why I'm a little bit, I'm a bull and a bear on Bitcoin.
Right.
Obviously bullish on Bitcoin because it's a certain number amount, people love it, whatever stuff. But I'm a bear on Bitcoin because the Fed isn't gonna let that happen. Yeah. Right. They are not gonna be dethroned as the most valuable actor. I only know of two people in history that tried to buy large amounts of oil without using US dollars. Because right now in the world, if you're in Egypt and you want to buy oil from Germany or whatever, or vice versa, you have to send your money through a SWIFT account. They change it into US dollars and then they change it to German marks. You have to use US dollars for any transaction in the world. And they do that, it creates demand for US dollars, right?
As the reserve currency.
As the reserve. I only know two people that didn't do it. Number one was Saddam Hussein. He bought large amounts of oil and sold without using US dollars. And somehow he got killed, right? He was killed by the US. The other guy is Umar Gaddafi, if I'm saying his name right, Gaddafi. Yeah. He bought large amounts of oil without US dollars and somehow he got killed by the United States. So I think it is going to be an absolute fight. You see Russia and China buying huge amounts of gold right now. They are stockpiling gold like crazy. And it's interesting in Russia and China, they have 30 or 40 year term leaders, right? The United States, we have a part-time employee, right? We have a 4 or 8 year president that thinks in 4 to 8 year terms, right? Russia and China think in 20, 30 year economic plans. And China and Russia have already kind of announced they want to launch their own digital currencies. They want to become the new store of value. I think it's going to be a fight and could be a war over, right? Where is monetary policy at and who controls what's going on. So it's going to be a fight. And I think the Fed isn't going to go down to the fight. So they might come in and disrupt Bitcoin. They could outlaw, they could do all sorts of things, right? That's my bullish on Bitcoin because the Fed could just change the rules of the game. When someone tries to take someone else's power, they're not going to just let it go. So that's me. That's my ramble for 3 minutes, but yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think?
So if you had to pick an asset class, right? So like take a 7 year time horizon and we have to pick today of, you know, call it cryptos, oil, real estate, small business, digital business. If you had to pick an asset class that you think has that you would have to bet on and raise a fund on, you know, in terms of, because on a fund side, I assume you have to defend the macroeconomic trend a little bit. You got to be a little bit conversant, and then also the specific opportunity. Where are you the biggest bull on, I guess, what's the thesis of the fund that you're raising right now? That's probably the best.
Yeah. Well, that's a great, what am I doing? Right. What am I putting right behind? Real estate. It's a real estate fund we're doing. We've seen huge shifts in real estate in the United States. So we're trying to capitalize on that. And you guys are in Dallas and Utah, and you guys have seen that shift of states like California, New York, people moving and stay at home work and stuff. So we're trying to capitalize on that, of this big migration of people. I was reading a couple days ago, San Francisco, they had 128,000 people change their address in Q4 of 2020. And about 30,000 of those people changed within the city. Almost 90,000 people out of San Francisco left the state in Q4 of last year, right? New York has, I don't know, 15,000 empty apartments right now, vacant units, right? It's crazy, right? So you have these huge shifts. So that's what we're, and real estate's always a store of value. So it's a very safe bet. It's very, because I don't know what's going to happen. That's the big thing. I have no clue. I make bets on all those assets you just talked about to just diversify.
Right.
But if for me going all in, it's real estate right now, because it just makes sense. It's simple. It's an asset. It's going to hold some value forever.
Multifamily, single family.
We're doing, my business partner might be mad if I tell you exactly what we're doing, but retail and office kind of flex space.
Got it.
I'm creating retail and office and even warehouse flex space.
Development or acquiring?
Both. We'll do both. So yeah, it should be fun.
I think flex will be huge, as because flex is a good way to bet on online business with from real estate, because that's where that demand. Mm-hmm. goes, and warehouse, industrial, you know, with data centers and all that stuff.
A lot of people need, and then overseas, you know, it's hard. Now we've realized you can't just ship everything from China anymore.
Manufacturing has to get onshore.
Sometimes have inventory on hand. So we're designing things just for those types of businesses and kind of stuff like that. So it's fun. That's what we're going into. What about you guys though? What do you guys think? 7 year horizon.
So I have a quick question really quick about something you were talking about. So you manage how many funds right now?
Currently just one. This is my second fund. We closed our first fund. We're launching a third fund here. So two funds.
Okay. Is there an advantage to having multiple different funds, or if you're diversifying each fund, like why not just make one massive fund?
It's a good question. Some funds do that. So, Jim Simons, right? He has his medallion fund. They kind of do you know, he can kind of do whatever he wants with that fund, right? For most small, I'm a small time fund manager, right? I'm not Ray Dalio or Warren Buffett, right? I can't, investors are betting on my thesis. And so typically a fund manager will launch funds based on a thesis of saying, hey, we are only going to do class B multifamily apartments, right? And because you are trying to show an investor, hey, I have expertise in this area, you know, this small little niche, we're going to do B class apartments, multifamily, you know, from this range, that's all we're doing. That's what you're trying to prove to an investor. It's a lot harder pitch when you say, hey, you know, Ryan, you're going to invest in my, you know, fund. Hey, I'm good at real estate. I'm also really good at crypto. Oh, and I'm a stud at buying up small businesses. Can you invest in my fund? We're going to do all of those at the same time. The investors typically are a little more skeptical. Like, really, you think you can do all those, right? They want to see expertise. So that's typically why you see different funds for, and now an investor can invest into each fund if they want. But typically you have a different management team or a different expert investor on each fund. That's what we've seen in our funds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. How many investors do you feel like are in it just to invest in you? Like they're just confident in you and what you want to do with the fund?
I think it's always a mix. I think
because I'm in if you'll, but I'm not one of those $2 million guys. I'm like the $5,000 neighbor.
You're unaccredited, bro. He doesn't want you.
Yeah, I know. And I'm going to call you next Tuesday about it too.
So. Yeah. Keep hitting me up all weekend about it.
Yeah.
So I think it's always a mix of both. They've got to love you. They got to know, like, and trust you. And they're always, you know, they're always going to bet on the jockey more than the horse. And they got to know they can trust you because there's a million ways that someone like me or whoever could run and try to go, you know, they got to chase them and lawsuit. They don't want to deal with that, right? They want to see that you're a person with integrity and honesty and really can manage money well. And then secondly, on top of that is the thesis. So I would say it's 50-50. I would say 50% is on me as a person, my background, integrity, who they know I am. And secondly is the thesis, right? Is what opportunity is this jockey going to get into? And do I want to allocate some dollars to that? And sometimes for investors, it's just like, hey, it's not the right time for me. You know, I've got some bills, whatever is coming up, and you know, hit me up in 6 months or hit me up on your next fund, right? On a different idea. So I would say it's about 50-50 between the person, the jockey, the team, and the thesis. Now some investors will tell you it's like 90% the team and 10% the thesis. In my personal experience, it's been about 50-50 as me starting as a first time fund manager starting.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
To answer your question on what where I'm focusing my efforts, I think the baby boomers hold a lot of businesses that they have to transition out of over the next couple years. And so where I'm focusing my efforts, I started as a real estate attorney. Real estate, I think, is the best place to, once you have wealth, to put it. But in a generative sense, I've done so much real estate development from a retail side, being the tenant and the owner, that I just don't have it in me right now to do real estate development. So where I think, and crypto and equity trading, I just don't, it doesn't grab my attention naturally. Like if I were to get into crypto tomorrow, it would be just the sole force would be like a FOMO force. And yeah, there's nothing worse than losing money based off of a FOMO thesis because I've done it. And so I think small business is where.
Well, that's smart too. You have potentially Biden coming in and changing capital gains rules and tax changes. And a lot of these longtime owners of businesses might say, hey, screw it. I've held this asset for 25 years. I just need to dump it. And before I get taxed double next, you know, if I sold it.
And you have an amazing stress test with coronavirus, how these things have survived. And so you don't have to guess how they will perform on a moving forward basis. So I think that's where I'm going to go, but I know we're a little past time, and dude, I think, you are doing something awesome. I think it's going to create a lot more entrepreneurs. I think it's a cheat code. Like I usually tell people to acquire small businesses as opposed to starting, because it's so much less risky than the normal entrepreneur story that you see on Instagram with Lambos and Ferraris. And the fund piece of it, solving the capital piece, is another massive piece. So to those listening, if you go to Investment Fund Secrets, investmentfundsecrets.com, find Bridger Pennington on Instagram. And, if you have any questions, or if you're interested in doing a fund, I've bought his product before. I would buy it again. I'm probably going to have to join his mastermind just to do it. So check those things out, and you won't miss it. Bridger, I appreciate the time, bro.
Hey, thank you so much. That was a pleasure.
All right, man.